bit more, 49 degrees. Both were seen in Kenosha. 45 for Burlington, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. Wind from the southwest at 10. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Support for the morning show comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. Support for the morning show also comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad. And we welcome you to the Monday morning show on WGTD-HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg, and I am really happy to be starting this week of morning shows with a faculty colleague of mine at Carthage, Dr. Eduardo Garcia Novelli. He is the director of choral activities there, specifically conductor of the Carthage Choir, but also in his free time, which there isn't all that much, he is the conductor of a really superb choral group up in Milwaukee, the Master Singers. And the Master Singers are coming down to Kenosha for the next concert in the Fine Arts at First series. And in part one of today's morning show, we're going to be hearing about the Master Singers of Milwaukee and about the really, really intriguing concert that is planned for this Sunday afternoon. In part two of today's program, by the way, you'll hear my conversation with UW Parkside's Brian Gill about their next theatrical production, which actually opened this past Friday by one of Norway's greatest playwrights, Henrik Ibsen, and his play called Hedda Gabler. So we'll be hearing about that in part two of today's program. But we begin with Dr. Eduardo Garcia Novelli, and we welcome you to the morning show.
Good morning, Greg.
Good to have you here. Thank you. You have been a world traveler as of late, and actually a lot of people in your line of work actually do a whole lot of traveling around. Maybe you could just say a quick word about where you have just been and maybe where you're headed next.
Well, the biggest trip over the last couple of months or so, actually I was fortunate to be a guest conductor, a guest clinician, and a guest lecturer at the Academy of Music in the city of Ljubljana, the capital of Slovenia, and is the University of Ljubljana. So it's a beautiful, beautiful country, reminiscing of older times, right, when the country was part of the former Yugoslavia. Slovenia is the northern part of the former Yugoslavia, bordering with Austria and Hungary and a little bit with Italy, as well as Croatia in the south. Ljubljana is a beautiful, beautiful city. I think it's a green, it's considered one of the green capital of Europe or something like that. I believe it's so many trees, it's open, there's a river that goes through downtown. It's beautiful, very, very beautiful. And so this is an agreement, an exchange agreement with Marko Vatovec, who is the choir director at the academy there. And so I taught some classes to conducting students, both in actual choral conducting and also in choral literature. And then a choir called the Ave Chamber Choir that is under the direction of Mr. Vatovec. We had two long rehearsals. For those of you who are in the field, you will be surprised. Each one of those rehearsals was 4 hours long.
Wow.
Yeah. You know, they have two breaks, and they have some food in between and fun, whatever. And then we offered two concerts, one in the city of Brezice and the other in downtown Ljubljana. It was a fantastic experience. That was at the end of January. And then actually Marko Vatovec, again his name, he will hopefully come here and visit us next year in the spring as well. And we hope to be able to do something similar with him, both a little bit at Carthage and with my master singers, since we're talking about them now.
Super. And we probably should, for the sake of our many listeners who have never actually seen the master singers in concert before, we really need to help people understand just what a superb group this is. Ahead of describing the group, how long have you been their director? It's been a few years.
Actually, this is my year number 6 with them. So
wow.
I started in August of 2010. But the group has been in existence for 40 years. It had been sort of an offspring of Lutheran a cappella. Then at the beginning, the name was Schutz Choir. And then for a while, the group was actually directorless. So they had, not necessarily that they performed without a director, but they didn't have a continual artistic director. So it was like a guest director per different programs. And but for a while now, they have been having a stable director. Before me, it was Eric Townell for about 6 years, I think. And as I said, this is my year number 6, so I'm having fun with them.
You are certainly busy enough just with all you do at Carthage. What was it about this opportunity that you found so attractive that you wanted to fold in a weekly commute all the way up to Milwaukee and devote a lot of time and energy to something like this? What did this offer to you that, in a sense, everything else you do at Carthage maybe didn't quite offer?
Sure. Well, one of the many things is the fact that I love working with college students, of course. That has been my life for a long time. And you feel a little bit of a, say, frustration of the fact that, well, they come to their senior year, they're 22, whatever, and that's the end of the story. And I feel that probably a group like the Master Singers is kind of the continuation in real life of people who go out and either do music or do other things, but they find their love in choral singing. And they do it, as I said, with a lot of love. Some of the members, of course, of Master Singers have been part of the group for a long time. And many of them have a lot of education, music education, vocal education, a lot of training, mm-hmm. that word, which is always sounded like a strange word to me, because training means more like some sort of sports of some sort. There is a little bit of sport in the field of singing, as you will know. But I like more the word education or experience, perhaps, or whatever. So many of the members, if not all, are very, very well versed into choral singing, and of course it is a challenge because it's only one night a week. We only meet on Tuesday nights, and having a program ready in about 2 months of work. So that means that we do 4 programs in the year, starting in late August and finishing in May, with logical breaks for Christmas and so on. It's a challenge, and so that the putting together those ideas of continual singing with people above and beyond the age of college, and also a group that has a wonderful tradition of singing great choral music over the years, and the challenge of putting together a program in a short time with only one night a week. All that combined is really very attractive.
Hmm. It is a strong group, and of course it's also the kind of group where not just anybody can show up and say, I want to sing in the Master Singers. I mean, it's, I'm sure, a rigorous audition process that is involved, because you really are, because of what you've just described, you're really interested in singers and musicians of a certain caliber, I mean, who can really function and flourish in a group like this and under some of these really challenging time constraints that are part of it.
It is a non-professional group in the sense that nobody is paid. I mean, yes, I am paid, but not the members of the choir are paid. Some of them actually have had some level of professional career at some point in their lives. But I would say that yes, this is not a newcomer kind of group. There is a minimum of ability that I look for to become a member of this group. At the same time, I do believe in people being able to grow and achieve that level. But let's say that this is not a group for a newcomer in the field. I would agree with that. Yes.
Mm-hmm. How big a group is it? I'm trying to. I've seen it enough that I should have a better idea than I do of how many singers are in
it. For this particular program, we have 33 singers. It's always around that number, around the number 30. You know, having four distinct programs in the year. So that gives us the chance of having somebody who will not sing, for instance, the second program of the year, will come back for the third, or things like that. But always it's about the number 30, around the number 30.
And you like that size of group?
I think it's great, yeah. I think that gives us a lot of flexibility because it's more or less technically still kind of a chamber choir, but yet you can have divisi and things like that, and the sound can be big and powerful as well. So it gives us a lot of flexibility, yes.
So the concert that's coming up this Sunday afternoon, we want to remind people this is part of the Fine Arts at First series at First United Methodist Church here in Kenosha. Is a free concert open to the public, and you have put together a concert which consists of two different masses, and it sounds like these two works are going to fit together beautifully and yet be quite distinct from one another. Just say a word about why you chose, first of all, to just in general, put the concert together in this way.
Sure. Before that, I really would like to express my gratitude to Jessica DeBoer for her vision about this concert series. I think it's very successful. They do a lot of things, as you will know, because you're part of that as well in December. But I mean, the season and what she does there, I know that has been coming for a long time, before Jessica. I believe David Scripsema was part of that,
yes.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, people have been working in the community for a long time with an illustrious tradition. So very thankful for that invitation, for that vision. Yes, the program is entitled A Journey Through the Americas. And the reason for that is we're doing two masses. The first part is a mass called Missa Ego Flos Campi, which is a parody mass, and we can talk briefly about that in a second, by a Spanish/slash Mexican composer called Juan Gutierrez de Padilla. And more of that in a second. And then the second part is a misa called Mass of Two Worlds by the Argentinian-American composer Ariel Quintana. So, yes, it is a program that this is based in two masses. One that is the what is called the Latin American Baroque era. And the second part is a living composer. Ariel is a composer who lives in the West Coast, and he was born in Argentina, like me, as you know. And he came to the U.S. even before me in the late 80s, and he lives in L.A. He did graduate studies here, completed a doctorate in musical arts at the University of Southern California, and he's a choral director, but also a composer and a pianist, And he studied with Morten Lauritsen, among others. So, as you know, he studied with somebody very well known in the field of choral music.
Is this somebody that you know personally?
I do, yes. However, I met him here in the U.S. I had not met him when he was living in Argentina. But I met him, you know, when you go to conventions and conferences and reading sessions and all that kind of thing. Paths are easy to cross when you know somebody from your land. So Ariel has a beautiful, beautiful way of writing, very lyrical. The fact that he is a pianist and really a great one, and also a choral director, gives him this sense of lyricism, I think, that is very interesting.
Hmm. Mm-hmm. The first piece you mentioned, the Missa Ego Fluscampi, the title refers to something about flowers in the field, I think. I think that's what Fluscampi means. Mm-hmm. Why is that in the title?
Well, that's funny, because when we talk about a parody mass, it means that the composer, let me give you an example. There's some Missa Omanium Mysterium by Tomás Luis de Victoria, another great composer of all times, yeah. One of the towering composers in the Western world, particularly the Renaissance music. So to write the Missa Omanium Mysterium, Victoria went on and based that mass, that Missa, on his own motet called Omaium Mysterium. So when we have a parody mass, means that the composer is basing his or her composition, long composition, based on something smaller, pre-existent.
Someone else,
it may be, right? Mm. You know, for instance, right now, Carthy Squire, we're doing music like the Misa Pangelingua that is based on the chant Pangelingua. Okay, that will be probably a Cantus Firmus Mass, because there's a melody that's existent. But when you have a long composition, right, already a choral composition, then that will be a parody mass based on another. So the point is that the piece called Ego Fluscampi has not been found. So we're not really exactly knowing how the original was.
So we don't know that original piece upon which this mass is based.
Correct.
Mm-hmm. So it's almost like the Enigma Variations of Elgar, where we don't know what that original theme exactly is, but we have all the variations he wrote.
I guess so.
I mean,
I
not that so. The theme was lost, but it's a little bit of a mystery. So
what is, among many other things, what is interesting about this piece and the composer is that Juan Gutierrez de Padilla, once again, he was born in, I believe, 1590 in Spain. But then he moved to Mexico, and he was employed at the cathedral in Puebla. So this is the typical example of a European-trained, educated composer that moves to the New World. And there are several examples of that, both mostly in Mexico and also in what is now Bolivia and Peru and all that area. Chiquitos, there's a famous site in that area of the world where there's archives that are very famous about music of the time, right? Hmm. So back again to Puebla, the Cathedral of Puebla, where they had really very highly elevated music making. And the interesting thing, this mass, for instance, is a double choir mass. So you need forces to do that. We're going to do it with a quartet that sings one of the choirs, and the choir responds in sort of a responsorial way. Mm. And at the time, also, you had the ability of combining instruments and voices, and it was completely common to double the parts with different sorts of instruments of the time. What is also very interesting is the musical language that he uses. And we're talking about yes, music that sounds European, but at the same time has a bit of this rhythmical Latin American influence. Hmm. Of course, not the Latin American rhythms you will think today, but yes, at that time as well. If you hear this, you wouldn't say this is really completely European, and at the same time, you wouldn't probably guess that it's completely Latin American. So it's an interesting mix of the two cultures.
Yeah. In terms of however Western it sounds, so would this sound roughly like Bach or Handel or Vivaldi? Or is it older than that?
I wouldn't go that far. It's a little bit somewhere in between. The sound, even though we call it Latin American Baroque, the sound is like sort of an early Baroque sound. I don't know. It could be a late Renaissance sound. So I will probably... I mean, it will be daring for me to say that compares to Monteverdi, but somebody like that,
okay.
That was, with, you know, with that sort of, as we know, Monteverdi is a sort of a perfect bridging composer
right.
between Renaissance and Baroque. So that, I guess that that's a little bit of that that could be associated, but not as far as going to Bach or Handel, no.
I suspect that this is a brand new work for essentially all of your singers.
Yes, for all of them it is. Curiously enough, I had done one or two movements of the Mass 3-4 years ago with Carthage Choir here on campus. But this is the first time I do the whole piece. And for the entirety of the singers is new. Yes, you're right.
Very good. Mm-hmm. And they've enjoyed the challenge?
So far, yes. And it was very difficult to get a hold of the music because the music is not published, by the way.
Mm.
And only four of the movements, you know, the five typical movements of the Mass, Kyrie, Gloria, Credo, Sanctus, Benedictus, and Agnus Dei. Four of the movements were available in CPDL. CPDL is called Public Domain Library, which is an online resource for music that is out of copyright law, and which is perfectly legal to download and perform. So the person who posted that music there is the person who made a recording, and he's a conductor from England. Hmm. I had the recording. It's an amazing, amazing recording. So I went ahead and contacted him and praised him for his work because it's an amazing recording. And I asked about the credo, which was not available. And he said, well, no, I don't have it. I didn't have time to edit that and to put it on CPDL. So I'm sorry, I cannot help you with that. It's not available, blah, blah, blah. So I felt, this is, of course, months ago, so I found myself in a little bit of a trouble, and I did a little bit of research and found a dissertation done many, many years ago by somebody in the West Coast. And so I asked for the score in interlibrary loan, and there was a microfilm where the credo was there in handwriting.
Oh.
So it's a little bit of really a lot of research to find it. We printed that, and we were able to rescue the credo and be able to perform it.
Wow. So you're doing the entire Mass then?
Yes, yes. And it's not that long, though. It's a little bit over 20 minutes altogether. So some movements are very short. Of course, the Gloria and the credo are the longest, as you know, because of the text. But we're talking about 20-some minutes for the first piece.
Mm-hmm. As for the second piece, then, this is the contemporary composer still living and who, like you, shares kind of this dual identity of being born and raised in Argentina but now living in the United States. Tell us more about, musically, what people are going to hear in the Mass of Two Worlds.
Well, his idea of the title, Mass of Two Worlds, he probably is, he told me he's trying to put on paper his experiences of being a native Argentinian and now an American citizen and living in the U.S. and working in the U.S. So the piece reflects some really beautiful folk rhythms, folk ideas of music from Argentina. And at one moment, even it has, you know, every time I get to that moment, it's like, this is Piazzolla. If you know the name of the avant-garde tango composer of Argentina, probably the most revered and most prestigious tango composer and performer. He was an amazing bandoneon player. He died in 1992, I believe. And his music is very specific, like very the type of music you hear something by Piazzolla, and you know it is Piazzolla. Kind of saving the big distances, of course, with the master of all times. When you hear Bach, you know it's Bach, just by the style, by what the sounds you hear, you know it's Bach. Well, with Piazzolla, the same thing happens. So Ariel sort of quote unquote stole a little bit of his style, and when you hear this. Just little section in the piece, you know he's paying homage to Piazzolla. But also there's some rhythms and folk rhythms there that are very interesting. And even something that's very, very cool, he told me in a live conversation that when he was living in Argentina, particularly in Buenos Aires, he was a member of the choir at the Alliance Française in Buenos Aires. And the director of that choir at the time, Julio Fangosh is his name, he was a lover of French choral music. So they did a lot of French choral music, meaning the style of Poulenc and Debussy and Ravel and all that, all those composers. And earlier than that as well. So there's a section in the Sanctus that really the harmonic language and everything really pays homage to that part of his experience. But then, of course, he came to the U.S. and he is now and has been for more than 20 years part of the choral scene in the United States. And studying at USC, University of Southern California, he was a composition student at Morton Lauritsen. So there's a little bit of that harmonic and compositional style that he influence that he received here in the U.S. So put that all together in a sort of musical salad, term, if you will, and stir a little bit, and then with the text of the Mass, and then you have that. The Mass is accompanied by piano. You know, he's a pianist, and he did a really nice job writing for that as well.
Very good. And of course, there's a gorgeous Busendorfer grand piano at the First United Methodist Church that your wonderful pianist will enjoy playing, I'm sure. I don't believe this happens all that often, that the Master Singers perform outside of Milwaukee, or am I wrong about that?
You're right. In one of the difficulties of a group like this is that it's completely independent. So we are not associated with any institution of any type, not with a school, not with a church, not with a financial organization. We are our own entity. So we really survive based on donations, on grants that we're able to write and pursue. Or whatever. Even the members of the group also help maintain the group alive. So we really appreciate this invitation from Jessica DeBoer and the Fine Arts at First series, because it gives us the chance to go a little bit out of Milwaukee and offer our art somewhere else. The concert actually also will be offered the day before, on Saturday at St. Patrick's Church in Milwaukee. And because this sort of Hispanic flavor of this program, in the church there's a group of, there's a choir, there's a children's or youth choir that will participate also in this concert, and it will be in the middle between the two masses. They will perform four or five pieces.
Oh, what a nice idea. Great. So the concert is free to the public on Sunday afternoon at First United Methodist Church. And what time does the concert begin?
3 p.m.
3 o'clock. Mm-hmm. And First United Methodist Church, of course, is at the corner of Sheridan Road and 60th Street. And it's a lovely space for making music. And I'm sure your choir is going to enjoy that experience, as will the people who come to enjoy this concert. Again, two different masses, the Missa Ego Flos Campi and the Mass of Two Worlds, performed by the Master Singers of Milwaukee under the direction of Dr. Eduardo Garcia Novelli. Professor Garcia Novelli, great to talk with you today, and best wishes to you and to your wonderful Master Singers of Milwaukee for Sunday afternoon's concert.
Thank you, Greg. Thank you for having me.
Good to have you here. Now for part two of today's program, you'll hear the conversation which I recorded last week with Brian Gill, who is artist in residence at the University of Wisconsin-Parkside in the theater department. We had a conversation where we talked about their newest production, which just opened on Friday, a presentation of a play by Norway's greatest playwright, Henrik Ibsen, a play called Hedda Gabler. Here's a portion of our conversation. I think it's really, really exciting that Parkside is taking on this play called Hedda Gabler, which I've heard of but never seen, and I really look forward to experiencing it in person. Did you have anything to do with it being chosen, or with you being the director of it, accepting the challenge? Or, I mean, were you at all a catalyst in this appearing in the season?
In no way was I involved in the selection of the play. When I was hired, the season was already decided, and I think, luckily and happily, jumped at the opportunity to be back at Parkside, but also to take on one of my favorite quote unquote classical playwrights. I'm an odd man, Greg, and I really love Henrik Ibsen's voice. Now, I mean, it's a translation, so I don't speak the original language, so you know, a proximity maybe, but that really distinctive troublemaker who writes these great plays that kind of force us to look at things that we're very much aware of, but we just, even now, 100 some odd years later, we don't particularly like to talk about out loud and in mixed company.
Right, and of course, if we don't now, we can hardly imagine these things being talked about ever, even behind closed doors back in 1891, which is, I think, when Hedda Gabler was first seen. Ahead of us talking specifically about the play and its story, tell us something about Norway's greatest playwright. What's important for us to know about him and his legacy?
You know, he was really the revolutionary dirty old man of the theater. He would take on these topics, you know, that people really didn't want to look at. Inequality and infidelity in marriage, hypocrisy in our leaders, political and religious, and inequality of the sexes. That's a major thing in Hedda. You know, what happens when the smartest person in the room is a woman in a time when that's just not really okay? And she has many, many, many flaws. But I came at this from the point of view of she's deeply and profoundly frustrated. It is not a fair world. I mean, it's not a fair world in general, but it's she is controlled. She is a second-class citizen because of the time. And yet she has this great wit and intellect, and she wants to play with the boys, but she's never allowed to play with the boys. And what happens when somebody of that sensibility and passion is essentially caged? And how does the idealist survive in a realist's world? And Ibsen would argue that they don't.
How typical is this work compared to other things that Ibsen wrote? I mean, was he making a really distinctive statement, unlike the statements made in anything else he created, or is this, in a sense, typical of what he was about as a playwright, especially?
I think, well, his big three, you know, the ending of Western civilization as we know it, came about with Doll's House, Ghosts, and Enemy of the People. And, you know, with Doll's House, it's the spoilers, but the end of the play, the young lady leaves her husband and children because she realizes that to stay would be a death sentence. And she is just that. She has spent her life being a doll in a doll's house. And, of course, get the torches and the pitchforks, because now suddenly Ibsen is advocating a woman's right to do what is best for her instead of suffering in silence. Hanging on in quiet desperation, kind of a thing. And I think, you know, there are elements of that in Hedda, you know, the battle of the sexes and where your place is, especially if you are a woman. But you can imagine with all of these plays, I mean, my imagination goes to the place of, you know, I can hear the audible gasps of several hundred people in a theater when Hedda just carries on, and she is, you know, she's being a holy terror, but she's really not. She is trying to be her own person,
in a way that, again, that would be truly shocking in 1891, and is still to some extent even shocking today. We should say something about kind of the kernel of the story of Hedda Gabler, as I understand it. As the play begins, she is, I think, newly married.
Yes.
And quite unhappily married. Although it's probably important to say that it's not that she's married to a monster, but she's married to someone who does not make her happy and is in a situation in a marriage that does not make her happy. Talk about Hedda's unhappiness within this marriage.
Well, and she states in the play when another character, a friend of hers, the judge, essentially says, you know, why on earth did you get married then if you're so unhappy? And she says, I had danced my last dance, Judge. Mm. She feels or felt that she stayed at the party just a little bit too long, and the young suitors weren't paying her as much attention as they used to. And then this young academic professor and researcher started to pursue her, and I think it may have seemed like she didn't have any options. She knew the judge was unattainable. Her previous relationship with the writer, and I always kind of think of him as a Byron-esque kind of bad boy poet, you know, Eilert Lovborg, tanked, and he has been gone for many, many years. And so I think that fear of, and again, it's an odd concept for us to think about, fortunately, in this fascinating modern age we live in. But a young woman who is no longer, quote unquote, young and is not married. And where do you go from that? Right. You know, you've got two options. You can be a spinster or you get married. Mm. And her father's long gone. She's the daughter of a general. And there are allusions in the text that he was quite a force of nature. So what happens when the major influence, male influence in your life, is this larger-than-life militaristic superhero, and you find yourself alone in a house with a bookworm?
Right. Who doesn't interest you all that
exactly.
much.
Exactly, yeah.
And, of course, what complicates the story then for Hedda is that at some point, and it sort of looks like it's fairly early in the story, she ends up re-encountering with this previous lover that you met, someone very, very gifted but very troubled. Do I remember? He's
absolutely
kind of an alcoholic.
Very troubled. He is a raging alcoholic who has been clean and sober for several years, but succumbs to essentially to the siren song of society again. Mm. He's been out, you know, in the provinces as a tutor, and has gotten sober and has written a book while out there that has then gotten published, and everyone's now starting to take notice of him again. And again, in Ibsen's time, a second chance was almost impossible.
Hmm.
If you blew it, you blew it. And if you fell hard.
Forever.
Exactly. And that idea that is in a lot of Ibsen's plays, the shock and terror of what will the neighbors say?
Hmm.
You know, what will society say? So he has now come back and is in part succumbs to his desire for Hedda, but I think also he's called back, that siren song. It's easy to behave yourself when there are no temptations.
Mm. And I suppose the fact that he has, in a sense, recreated himself or managed to create the second chance for himself probably is something of an inspiration to Hedda, that maybe she doesn't have to settle for what feels like a really unhappy and unfair lot for herself.
And she's, you know, she's really fascinating because she flat out says to him that she will not cheat on her husband. She's not going down that road. She loves to flirt. She loves the excitement of it. I think anything that reminds her of being a young woman in her father's home, in, you know, in which there was constant entertainment and they were constantly entertaining. There's a reference that she would go riding with her father. She's desperate for a horse again.
Hmm.
You know, that in itself is kind of scandalous, this idea of a young woman riding free,
yeah,
you know, out in the wilderness on a horse. You know, I don't think so. But yeah, she is trapped in a cage of her own making in some ways.
Hmm. Do I remember correctly that her former lover now is married, and that one of the things that sort of drives Hedda crazy is jealousy about what her lover has with his wife?
Yes, he's not married. He has developed a relationship with a young woman named Thea, who, here's where it gets complicated. She is desperately unhappily married to a provincial governor or some sort of just kind of mean old man.
So she and Eilert are having an affair then?
It is alluded to. Okay. It's never said in that way, but she certainly is in love with him. And she has helped him write this new book that no one has seen yet, that is the play gives you the feeling that it is going to be the greatest book of the 19th century.
Hedda is jealous of that collaboration.
She's jealous of everything. You know, she went to school with Thea, and Thea was timid and kind, and not to say that Hedda doesn't have moments of kindness, but Hedda was better looking and smarter and bolder and brasher, which again, no. But Hedda is desperate. She sees men all around her with the power to control other people's lives. And she is constantly reminded of her inability to do so. And then Thea and Lovborg come back to town, and she sees the amazing power that Thea has had over Eilert Lovborg, Hedda's previous lover. And absolutely, it just does not sit well with her. She is desperate to have some sort of control.
And, of course, that desperation, that jealousy drives her to do some incredible things that we'll leave it to our listeners to experience that for themselves. Say a quick word about how your cast has embraced this work, and maybe say a quick word about the crucial casting of the title role, which is one of the towering roles for any actress.
It has been referred to as the female Hamlet, not as a comparison to that particular character, but just the complexities of the play itself. And I knew going in, that if Hedda came across as mean, we were doomed. Because that's really interesting for about 5 minutes. Right. And then you're just watching a despicable person do despicable things because they're despicable. And I had no desire I wouldn't want to watch that. I certainly didn't want to direct it, but I wouldn't want to observe that as an audience member. And as an actor, I wouldn't want to be acting in something like that. So, you know, the good news is Parkside has an amazing group of young, developing artists that kept rising to the challenges of these auditions. The bad news is Parkside has an amazing number of really talented young artists that kept rising to it.
I'm so sorry.
I know. I mean, it's an embarrassment of
heck
riches.
Heck of a problem to have.
Absolutely. So, you know, we did the auditions, and then we did the callbacks, and I essentially was looking at two very viable casts. And then it came into, okay, well, what, you know, thinking about how these people interact, what they, you know, all of the picky stuff. How do they look together? How are they going to work together? How, you know, previous experiences with them and all that. Olivia Krause ended up with the role, not ended up with the role, earned the role. And I had previously directed Olivia in Book of Days the last time I directed for Parkside. You know, that was a few years ago. And Olivia has this wonderful ability to take quote-unquote classical text and make them incredibly modern, incredibly contemporary, which is a double-edged sword, because actors who have that ability can very easily list into adding all sorts of modern expressions,
right?
Ums and you knows and things like that. But that's really fixable. You know, that's just, you just write them down and say, cut it out. You know,
yeah.
And that's something that was really appealing to me from a director point of view. Was if you decide you are directing a classical piece of theater, I believe, you are doomed. Because suddenly you are dealing with something that is carved in stone and 100 to 400 years old or 2,500 years old or however.
Right.
And you're not acknowledging the fact that 100-some-odd years ago, for example, Hedda Gabler was a brand-new play written by a revolutionary man who scared the pants off of society.
Right.
He was this dangerous little man with fabulous facial hair that was calling people out in a very public way and calling institutions out in a very public way. So I wanted that sense of this could have been written last week. That's really, and that's me as a director. That's also me as an actor. I don't want to play, I don't want to sound pretty. I don't want to use my actor voice and you know, stand thusly and talk at my audience, even though the fourth wall is fully engaged, the separation between actors and audience.
Right.
There is no direct engagement with the audience. Mm. But the audience is right on top of us.
Mm.
My friend and colleague, Jody Sikas, wooed me with his set designs to have audiences on three sides.
Ah.
So, and that front row is right there
wow.
in the action.
Wow.
Which, again, I think that dynamic helps remind us that we are watching a piece of living theater. We're not watching something shaped out of porcelain.
Right.
That if we try to put
a
our hands on
ago.
It. Yeah, a long time ago. That if we touch it, it's going to shatter.
Right. I mean, it's not just porcelain, but ancient porcelain.
Exactly.
And antique.
Yeah. Yeah. Just look at it. Don't look. You know. Don't touch it. Don't enjoy it. Don't
right.
learn anything from
right.
it. Just oh, it's Henrik Ibsen. Oh yes, Henrik Ibsen. Okay.
Yeah. Like it's an object that sits on the shelf.
Exactly.
Wow.
And that's death.
Right.
You know. And we've all seen those productions. And I've worked really hard, and so has my cast, to make sure this is not one of those productions. While and at the same time. Honoring the old man, who I have a great affinity for, honoring his words, and honoring the world of the play.
Hmm. Well, what a privilege to be able to experience a truly revolutionary work on the stage in what sounds like a very compelling production. So tell our listeners what they should do if they want to seek out tickets for
Absolutely.
These performances.
The dates of the performance are the 4th, 5th, 10th, 11th, and 12th. And all of those, the time for all of those performances are 7:30. There's also a 10 a.m. matinee on the 11th. You can call the box office at 262-595-2564 or harass them online at uwparksidetickets.com.
Brian Gill is artist in residence at the University of Wisconsin Parkside and the director of this production of Henrik Ibsen's Hedda Gabler. Tomorrow on the morning show, Professor Art Sear joins me from Carthage College to offer his analysis of all kinds of current events, both on the domestic front and on the international front as well. Wednesday's morning show includes a conversation with sports writer John Feinstein. Thursday, we'll be previewing for you a new production at the Milwaukee Florentine Opera. Support for the morning show comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe. Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. Support for the morning show also comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad. We're going to have increasingly cloudy skies today with a 50% chance for rain this afternoon. With a high of 58 degrees, overnight low of 50 degrees. Tomorrow, under cloudy skies, a 40% chance of rain with a high of 62 degrees. Wednesday, high of 58 degrees with still a very good chance of rain. And our temperatures are going to remain stubbornly in the low to mid-50s all week long and into the weekend.